Pets are such a wonderful part of life, aren't they? I was having fun this morning. We opened the window with it's going to be a nice day all day, and right away, Tiger with his his paws up, and he's looking out and smelling outside, and our little kitty, and really enjoying it.
I know, but you know, this beautiful weather, the side effect is that parasites are out there in full force. You know, I hate to be a, you know... make it such a downer, but you know, it is really important that we make sure that we've got our pets on not only heartworm but flea and tick prevention as well.
That voice, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Always great to have her along. She comes by once a month and we always look forward to it. And we're certainly going to talk about some of those things that we need to be aware of when we get our pets out, when we have our pets outside. You may have questions about inside as well with your pets. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And as always, we love photos of your pets. So you can post those up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And, you know, Sandy, you've got a menagerie.
I do. And, you know, and the pets that I have are all like the senior bulldogs and two older cats. And unfortunately today, probably almost as I'm speaking right now, I'm losing one of our pets. I'm not super attached to her, but it's my daughter's frog, Xenopus frog. And she was one of these frogs that back when she was like, my daughter's going to be 21 this year, but when she was 3, we bought this little kit called Love a Frog, where you get a tadpole and you watch it go through metamorphosis. Well, we have invested more in fish tanks and food and everything. But this company gives you like a free, if one dies, you get a free one. And so this was the third in line, and she's now 8 years old, cystic ovaries, and is having a hard time. So, you know, but even a pet like that deserves a painless death. And I didn't want to be there for it. So they're doing it while I'm at the show. And, you know, you get attached, even though it's a frog after 8 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one thing you don't get attached to is if your dog comes home after being sprayed by a skunk.
Oh, my goodness, yes. And, you know, it's not just the smell that you have to worry about. And I didn't really even know this. And so the reason why I started looking into it is that I had a client call me who had a dog that got skunked. And there's a recipe. You cannot get this solution available commercially. You have to make it yourself. But it's called the Krebaum, Krebaum. Skunk odor removal formula. And basically it's a quart of hydrogen peroxide, 3% hydrogen peroxide, and it needs to be fresh. So an unopened bottle, quarter cup of baking soda, and then 1 to 2 teaspoons of liquid dishwashing detergent. A lot of people will consider doing things like using a lot of soap, but the chemical that makes the smell, soap doesn't get rid of it. You need to use something like this peroxide. Be careful, it will bleach the dog, it will bleach you, because it is peroxide, but, you know, and do it outside. That's probably the best place to do it. But there's lots written online for that. You can't store it in a bottle, because it will explode, but that's a great recipe to have on hand. And maybe if you've got, you know, you live in an area where there are skunks, you know, having some fresh peroxide and everything ready just to be able to make that solution. But the problem we see, too, is that if they inhale or ingest a lot of it, the chemicals that make the odor actually help destroy red blood cells in dogs and cats. But if, you know, it's usually if they're sprayed in the face and they inhale it. And the recommendation is, if you've had a dog get a close shot, especially in the face, you probably want to take them in and get some blood work done. There have been dogs that have died from skunk exposure because it destroys the hemoglobin in the red blood cells, and then they can't carry enough oxygen and can potentially die. So I think it's one of those things where, you know, just it's not just the smell. You need to be aware that there could be life-threatening consequences.
When you and I were talking before the show about another aspect of pups or dogs, I should say, and that had to do with puppies and where you purchase Puppies, and you've reading some research on this. That's really interesting.
This is hot off the press. It just came out in this week's AVMA, American Veterinary Medical Association Journal, and it's the title of the article is "The Differences in Behavioral Characteristics Between Dogs Obtained as Puppies from Pet Stores and Those Obtained from Non-Commercial Breeders." I live in Janesville, and we have a couple of pet stores there that sell dogs, and those dogs come from puppy mills or commercial breeding facilities, and they're usually imported from other states. Often Missouri is a great spot for them to come to. And so we've got these little puppies that are being stressed and taken, you know, and transported across state lines. They're in a cage. They're getting constantly looked at. They may not be adopted during that real critical time. And, you know, I've always recognized the fact that these dogs tend to be not as healthy. They may not be genetically sound because they're just mass producing them. No. But I didn't really, you know, and then some of them have kind of iffy personalities. And I kind of said, well, maybe that's just due to the fact that, you know, they've been poorly socialized. They've been in a kennel situation. I know that these dogs are really hard to housebreak as well because they've been urinating and defecating in a kennel. So you go home and you get a crate for them so that when you're not home and they're like, whoa, good, they provided me with a toilet. So these dogs can be a real challenge. But what this study looked at is not just the health implications, but the behavior implications. And they looked at hundreds and hundreds of dogs across the board from where they came from. And what they found is that compared with puppies that came from non-commercial breeders, so that would be an at-home breeder, a backyard breeder, if you want to call it, a regular breeder, a whoops breeding, like in a family household or so, whatever, that if they came from the pet store, they had a significantly greater chance of having aggression towards the human family members and unfamiliar people. They have more dog aggression, and they also have a greater separation anxiety problem, which can be very difficult to get under control. And so why is this? Is it because of poor socialization? Maybe. But one of the theories is that when these moms are carrying these puppies, they're so highly stressed that the stress hormones and chemicals that the mom is making has an effect on the brain development of the puppies, which makes them more anxious and more, you know, not able to handle stress as well. So, you know, that at-home breeder that is, you know, hands-on, taking good care of those dogs, that would be a place to consider going. But, you know, they even looked at rescue dogs here, and they found that even dogs that came from rescue situations had much more sound behavior than dogs that came from a pet store. So avoid pet stores.
There you go. Norm in Wausau, thank you very much for calling. Hi, Norman.
Hi. Dr. Sawchuk, we have a problem with a five-year-old cat that about the Christmas time, we start noticing a lump on her left flank, and just thought it was a benign cyst of some type. Left it go, and finally it got about maybe almost an inch in diameter or so. And we took her to the vet, and he excised it. And he wanted to know if we should wanted it sent to the pathologist, and I said, no, it's probably just a benign cyst. We'll just pitch it. So about 3 or 4 weeks after that, not far from the incision line on the superior aspect, another lump appeared.
Oh, boy.
So we took the cat in again and had that excised. That one we sent to a pathologist. It turns out to be a fibrosarcoma.
Yeah, yeah.
And now, on the other end of the incision, kind of where the original one was, there's about 3 or 4 small nodules.
Mm-hmm.
A question to you is, what do you think we should do at this point? What's the likely outcome? Are there any chances for anything? Or
Fibrosarcomas
are one of those types of cancer that we do see in both cats and dogs. In cats, there's been a link with vaccines, and I'm not saying don't vaccinate your pet, but be careful. Veterinarians are being more careful about choosing what vaccines to use, using less of the killed vaccines if possible, and being careful at and administering the vaccines in body parts that may be expendable. The reason is that when a cat develops a fibrosarcoma, you need to do very wide surgical margins. These tumors are like an octopus. What you see of it is just the tip of the iceberg. And although the surrounding tissue may look normal, there's probably cancer cells there. And so taking very wide margins. And so for a cat that maybe has a fibrosarcoma on a limb, we would do a limb amputation. That would be ideal,
wow.
Which is why we give vaccines in the limb now. And that's where we like to see all vaccines in cats being given. And we like to separate them out in different areas so we can identify maybe what caused it. The incidence of fibrosarcomas with vaccines is about 1 to 5 in 10,000 inoculates. So it's really low, but it's still, you know, one of those things that we as veterinarians have to be really careful about and always inform the owner about, you know, watching and making sure that, you know, nothing's growing in that area. Probably the reason why that you're seeing these tumors recurring in other areas is very simply if there were towel clamps used and it went through the skin and maybe got some tumor cells on it, they got drugged to the surface. We'll see it even like along suture lines where every place where that suture material went through, a tumor starts growing. So depending on the location, you said it's on the flank, that may be very difficult to do wide margins. It really depends on, you know, how a surgeon can get everything pieced back together. After that's done, if there are clean margins, that may be it. But often there aren't, and you can't remove any more tissue. And so then you're looking at either radiation therapy, there may be some help with some of the chemotherapy protocols. And for that, I'd say, you know, visiting with a veterinary oncologist. We now have several around the state. The vet school has a wonderful program there, but there are several private practitioners that are boarded in oncology as well. So that would be another place to go looking and getting another opinion. So I'm sorry. It's a tough one to deal with.
Yeah, very tough. Thank you, Norman, and good luck. Appreciate your call. Tammy and Marshall, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Briefly, I'll comment on that skunk remedy. It works awesome.
Good.
I'm too familiar with it.
I know.
It works really great, and I always follow up with a commercial product, too, but that skunk remedy does work really well. And I'm glad to hear about the face spraying that if I need to get my dog in to get some blood work, you know, she seems fine, but we'll make sure. What I had originally called about was I had called, I think, in March to ask about a dermatology referral to UW, and we went ahead and got an appointment and went. I had a golden that's, you know, seems itchier than the Labrador, and we got a clean bill of health. We're still on some meds and things, but, you know, he has working dog syndrome versus allergies, so I was really, really happy that, you know, I'd never seen so many doctors go nose to tail over my dog.
Oh, yeah.
So attentive, and they just did such a fabulous job, and it really was, you know, very nice to, you know, ease my worries about, you know, oh, gosh, has he got something wrong? So just really,
right.
Really happy. So thank you, Dr. Sandy, for encouraging people to go.
You are welcome. And, you know, the vet school does have, you know, you name the specialty, we've got it there. And it's an amazing, amazing place to work. And, you know, people ask why, you know, why am I not out in private practice where I could, you know, develop my own practice? And it's because I love to learn. And being in that environment, we're always having to be on our toes and keep up with things. And there isn't a day that goes by where I'm not learning something new. And that is what we try to do with the owners that bring their pets in, is teach them as well so that, you know, not only the students are benefiting, but you're benefiting as well. I'm glad you had a great experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope we don't need to see any of your dogs again for specialty care, but know that we're there if you ever need us.
Thanks,
yes,
Tammy.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. That's a wonderful call.
Mm-hmm.
Mark in Rockton. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I know it's challenging introducing new cats together, and I've had the two most wonderful cats paired up here, very loving, and they're about 7 to 8 years old. One of them just died, and so I want to try to find another, I think, young adult. I read something that discouraged bringing in a kitten, that they would be kind of inappropriately wild and alienate the older cat. So my two questions are, do you have any tips for integrating new cats together, number one? And number two, what kind of infectious diseases should be tested for? And is there a kind of latency period or incubation period that you need to kind of isolate them before you can accurately test for these things?
Oh, great questions. And, you know, I am so glad that you're looking into this before you bring another cat in. I can't tell you how often we have people that, you know, end up going, oh, my goodness, I wish I had followed, you know, the advice of keeping them separated. For example, we just had a kitty cat in a couple of weeks ago that ended up having, it was a new cat that got put into the household and had been living there for a couple of months. The cat had ear mites. They also had two dogs and two other indoor cats. So the entire family of five needed to be treated for ear mites. Then the cat ended up coming down with a skin parasite that is contagious to other cats called Demodex, that is very different than dog Demodex. So the dogs didn't need to be treated, but then we're looking at these cats and it's like, oh my goodness. So if they had just done what you're doing, do a little homework first. So to answer your questions, you can do both things kind of simultaneously. I think it's a great idea to have the cats physically separated, where the new cat can get used to the sounds and smells in the house, and the old cats can get used to the fact that, you know, there's somebody in there. I can hear something, I can smell something, but keeping them behind closed doors. And that's really important, and every cat's different as to how fast they adjust to each other. It may be a matter of days, it may be months, and sometimes they never adjust, and you're looking at keeping them separated forever because you don't want them to be fighting. If you do release them too early and you get into a fight-ish situation, you may never be able to go back from there. You have to go back to keeping them separate and making sure that all contact is positive through the use of things like, we'll do things like maybe tie two toys together with a string and let them play under the door. We'll take a door down and put a screen door up instead, just an inexpensive wood screen door so they can see each other but not get at each other. You know, we'll open the door crack and have them eating something wonderful on either side. And that really helps make them think that that new kitty is, it means something good's going to happen. But the disease issue, I've already brought up one thing, ear mites and other external parasites. Getting a good physical exam done as soon as you possibly can. If you're going through, you know, one of the local shelters, a lot of times that's already been done, and many shelters have already started things like giving them ear mite medication, it's a topical medication that we'll use. They may have already done a stool check to look for parasites. And, you know, we will often repeat some of those things. The testing for some of the nasty systemic diseases like feline leukemia and FIV, we like to have that done as well. Ideally, we'd like to repeat everything that on those blood tests in about 6 months, but usually if we've got a negative and the cat's healthy and happy, you can start letting them mingle a little bit. But in an ideal world, we would keep them separated for a good 5 or 6 months before we start letting them mingle and share litter boxes, because we want to have those two negatives if we can get it. But it doesn't always happen.
Yep.
So, yeah, well, good luck with getting a cat. And, you know, I think it depends on your cats. Sometimes male-male cats get along better than female-female pairing. So, you know, and I don't know if it really makes that much difference regarding getting a kitten or not. It depends on how playful your cats are. If they were really elderly, a kitten could potentially, you know, drive them crazy. But 7-year-old cats should still have a little spunk. So
yeah, I would think so.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, we have, as you well know, we have two male cats, and they got along right from the first minute.
Yeah, and sometimes that happens, you know. They just adjust to each other, and you can just tell right away. But, you know, I think having them checked by a veterinarian before let them mingle is very important. Yeah,
very important. Steve and Anigo, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, great show. Very informative, as always. We have a larger kennel up north, along with some others. We race and raise sled dogs, and with some other sporting dogs in the area, and the incidence of Lyme's disease up here is just incredible. And doxycycline has always been a magic pill for us. But as of the last couple months, the shortage of doxycycline has been frightening.
Mm-hmm.
The same bottle of 500 that we paid $80 for last year is now online close to $1,000.
Right.
And
right.
When we talk to the manufacturer, they blame the FDA. The FDA blames the manufacturer. And we're really, really concerned up here about this situation. Do you think it is a temporary shortage, or do you think this is a long-term problem?
Oh, you know, this happens so often. We went through this with an anesthetic agent called propofol not too long ago. It goes in cycles with different drugs and manufacturers. But, I went to fill a prescription for a dog that actually lived in, not in the Madison area where I work, but down in the Dodgeville area. And when I called Walgreens to get their prescription filled, it went from being probably a $5 prescription to a $300 prescription.
Oh.
And so this is not only just for the veterinary world, but also for the human world. And although we have a little bit of it, our pharmacist is pretty good. We've got the pharmacists that work at the veterinary school, but the head of the pharmacy department saw this coming and kind of backlogged some, but he is, you know, we're only using it in dogs that are showing clinical signs of, you know, where we need to use it or have an infectious disease that only can only respond to that particular drug. Something like leptospirosis would be an example of that. So I've had dogs testing positive, and I just say, watch them for clinical signs. If they don't develop clinical signs, we're not going to treat. But eventually, we may have to start looking at using some of the alternative antibiotics that may not be quite as effective. Something like Clavamox, amoxicillin and clavulinic acid. Some dogs will respond to that. Again, that can be a little pricey, and it has more side effects for affecting the GI tract. But, you know, if you have a dog that develops clinical signs of Lyme disease, fever, lameness, you know, really lethargy, swollen joints, you know that the drug is available, but there are alternatives that we could actually use as well. Mm. So, yeah.
But how does a drug go from $80 to $1,000?
That's, you know, and this happened not too long ago with a psychoactive drug that we would use that's one of the Valium type drugs.
Uh-huh.
It just went off the scale, and there was a class action suit against the company for this drug, and a lot of people ended up getting their money back from you know, having a prescription that this was ordered for. It made me switch to a different one for treating the same types of behavior problems, but you know, so it's now back and it's cheap, but I'm happy with what I'm using now. So
yeah.
I don't. Why? But, so this is something that is pretty typical with the drug world.
Candace and Nina, hello.
Hi, thanks for talking with me.
Sure.
I have a female Cavalier King Charles Spaniel that's 7 years old, and she was diagnosed with dry eye, and then she developed an ulcer on her eye, and we've been treating this for about, probably 12 weeks, and our vet did a grid keratotomy.
Okay.
And then it didn't seem to be, it was supposed to start like the blood circulation to heal the ulcer.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't seem like that was happening much. So we went to an ophthalmologist 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kind of prescribed the same medication. We've got Optimmune and what's the other one? Gentamicin.
Okay.
And so we've been using that. But her eye is just so sore. We're going to be seeing him back this week.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't, I don't know, to me it doesn't look like it's healing. He talked about a procedure where they would sew her eyes shut.
Yeah, there's a number of things, and I have firsthand experience with this because right now my male bulldog, who does not have dry eye, but he ended up getting a corneal ulcer. And they actually give these non-healing or very slow to heal corneal ulcers a name. They call them a SCED, and it stands for superficial chronic something, spontaneous chronic epithelial defect or something. I don't know what it stands for, but ophthalmology always comes up with great words that I have a hard time remembering. So the Optimmune medication is to help stimulate tear production. And so I'm glad that your dog's on that. The gentamicin is an antibiotic. Real important that we do that as well. And so what your veterinarian had done is, you know, when I bring my dog into the ophthalmologist, they'll stain the eye, they'll take sterile Q-tips, and after putting in some numbing drops, take away any of the dead corneal tissue that it may be living, but it's not adhered down. And so they get in there and kind of, it would be like us with skin that's flaking, getting rid of those flakes on top of your skin. They're like a sunburn that's peeling. So they'll go in and do that. And then the grid procedure that was done, they use a little tiny needle and they put tiny, tiny holes all in the center of that ulcer. And what they're hoping to do is give kind of footholds for the cells that are growing to grow across and stick down rather than just kind of lumping up and continuing to grow and not attaching down and actually giving a good cover to that cornea. How many procedures does it take? Well, Vanna, my female bulldog who had this happen a couple of years ago, It took 3 grid keratotomies, and finally, after the third one, we ended up putting in a contact lens, and that was what worked for her. So she had a soft contact lens put in, obviously not one to correct vision. It just acted as a Band-Aid, and that seemed to work. Now, I don't know with the fact that you've got a, you know, a dog that's got droopy eyes, whether a contact will stay in or not, but sometimes just even a couple of days of having that on really makes a difference as well. Alternatively, going with a, you know, surgical procedure where you either do a conjunctival flap where they bring in tissue that line the eyelids and so on and bring it down, and you'll have a pretty good scar there, but that will fill the void. And so that's one thing that they'll do. Sometimes they'll take that third eyelid and sew it up so it's covering, then act as a Band-Aid as well to protect it so it can heal. So there are other procedures that can be done, but don't give up. It may take multiple treatments to get this under control.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's very helpful.
Thanks a lot for calling, Candace. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a health question about your pet, I hope you'll give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Larry Mueller here with my guest, UW Madison School of Veterinary Medicine Professor Sandy Sawchuk. Dr. Sandy with us today. And again, that number, 1-800-642-1234. And if you've got a photo, a pet photo, would love to see that as well. So send that on to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. An email from Mary Jo in Weston, who says, our Australian Shepherd has gained a couple of extra pounds over the winter. In addition to exercise to shed the pounds, I was told we could substitute half his dog food per day for green beans. So okay. Instead of 2 cups of dog food, you get 1 cup of dog food and 1 cup of green beans. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that that would be a very inappropriate way to lose weight. Although, you know, we tend to substitute salads and things for real, you know, meals. Dog food is a complete and balanced, at least it should be if you're using one of the good commercial brands, complete and balanced. And by cutting, for an Australian Shepherd to have, you know, only a cup of dog food a day, they're not going to be getting enough of the basic nutrients. They're not going to be getting enough protein. And although the dog may feel full from the green beans, it may backfire. And what can happen is they'll start breaking down their muscle tissue as a way to try to maintain their protein levels that they need. And so now you don't have as much tissue that has that high metabolism to burn calories, and you just get this like yo-yo dieting type thing where, and it's almost like a starvation diet. So I don't know where she heard that. I do recommend that rather than giving treats, giving some vegetables here and there, like a baby carrots or something if the dog likes them, is one way of making the owner feel good that they're giving something, but not giving something really high calorie to the dog. So I would rather see her switch to a lower calorie pet food, perhaps a light or a less active one, and maintain the volume so the dog's getting proper nutritional, meeting its nutritional needs.
Ticks, question again from Kevin. Last year he puts 2 labs on CertiFect. One was a little under the weather after the treatment, but we had no ticks all season. We live in Tomahawk, which is tick central. I then heard some horror stories about CertiFect, so I switched to my vet's recommended tick treatment, ND. We are getting ticks biting and filling with blood now. How dangerous, if at all, is CertiFect?
Well, what CertiFect is it's a combination of 2 chemicals. It's made by the company that makes Frontline, so one of the active ingredients is fipronil, and you're going to find that in lots and lots of different products over that are available over the counter and through your veterinarian. The problem we have is that ticks and fleas are biologically very different. When a flea climbs on board, it runs through the hair coat, and so any chemical that's on the hair, they're going to pick up quick, and they also tend to self-groom. So if you ever stop and watch a flea on your pet, they'll stop and kind of take their little feet and like lick them, like rub it all over themselves and keep themselves clean, so they're ingesting more of the toxic chemicals as well, toxic for them, not for the pet. And they die. So fleas, they tend to work very well. The problem with ticks is you have your dog outside, they brush up against a piece of grass that has a tick questing on it. wherever that tick lands, they just start feeding. They're not going to run through the hair coat like fleas do, so they may not get as much chemical exposure. So most of the flea and tick products you're going to see can take about 48 hours for the tick to die. So during that time, they may start feeding. They may or may not be transmitting disease as well. So they've added this other chemical in called Ametraz, and we've used Ametraz in the past. And found that, we've used it in dip formulations for treating certain skin parasites. It was used in another product called Promaris that the Fort Dodge company made, and that was another topical flea and tick product. Stunk to high heavens, and it really smells bad. And we noticed that in those dogs that were getting a lot of this Ametraz, because it was in a much higher volume, some dogs would develop a condition called pemphigus foliaceus, which is an immune-mediated skin problem, very difficult to treat, very painful, takes months sometimes to get under control. And so we thought when the Fipronil or the Frontline company came out with this new product, it had such a tiny amount of Ametraz in it that, it's probably not going to cause any trouble. But later on in the summer, there started to be reports, and although they're relatively rare, of dogs developing PF, pemphigus foliaceus. In fact, one of them was our dermatologist at the vet school. So not the person you want to have a problem with the product. So from that point on, we still have it in our pharmacy. If an owner really wants it, they can have it. And it does seem to work better for ticks, because what that a little bit of Ametraz does is makes the ticks behave like fleas. Rather than just start feeding, they start dancing. It affects their nervous system, so they move through the hair coat more, they pick up more of the fipronil that kills them, and they die faster. So that's probably what you were seeing last year. If your dogs tolerated it, and again, there's no guarantee that if you put it on once, twice, three times, at the fourth time, they may not have a reaction. We don't know that. But it's something that if an owner wants this, I go through this spiel with them and let them, it's a consumer beware type thing. So, it's available. You may want to look at something else. One of the new things that I have telling people about is there's a collar that the Bear Company makes called the Seresto collar that lasts for 8 months if they're not swimming a lot, 5 months if they're in the water a lot. And it appears to be fairly effective as well. So that might be another thing to consider trying.
Something else to try. Jay and O'Connell, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, guys. I have an American Water Spaniel. He's about one year old, just turned one. And he's having some splitting of his nails.
Mm-hmm.
And it will split, and it'll actually have little slivers that'll go all the way up to his paw. That outer covering is just splitting off. He eats a good dog, balanced dog food. So want to get your take on that.
Yeah, there's a condition that we see in dogs, and it's given the name onychodystrophy, which is it's also known as brittle claw problem, and it just shows up randomly. And it can be a very painful condition for these dogs to have, because the nails break easily. And treatment is usually directed at sometimes we will use things like low levels of doxycycline, which is the drug that's in short supply, but it also, besides being an antibiotic, helps modify the immune response that may be causing this. Sometimes we'll be using things like niacinamide, which is another drug that may help with keeping the nails in a healthier condition, balanced fatty acids. And so that would be what I would be looking into. And, I don't see this often enough, so every time I get a dog in with this, I have to pull out my dermatology book. Yes, I still have to pull out books once in a while and read about it, because there's a whole bunch of different things that can be tried. And now that we don't have doxycycline to be able to use easily, I'm probably going to be going down on the list to give this a try. So I don't think your dog needs to suffer. I think it's something that can be addressed, but it would mean going to your veterinarian and having that, having it looked at. You may have to trim some of those nails back to get rid of all those rough edges. He may need to wear booties to protect his feet while things are healing. And it may be lifetime management to be able to keep things under control.
Any supplements or nutrients?
The fatty acids. Fatty acid supplements may be able to help, but you have to be careful with what fatty acid supplements you're using. You want to have the right levels of DHA and EPA and so on. And so this would be, again, something that your veterinarian would be able to recommend a product that would be effective rather than just getting something over the counter. So time to go in, have those feet looked at, remove, and it may take sedation or even anesthesia to remove some of those nail fragments, start from scratch and protect those feet. And he's going to have a very sedate summer if his nails are like that. So,
Yeah. Good luck, Jay. Thank you for calling. Dalton and Mozani, hello to you. Hi.
Hi. I've been reading in some magazines that rosemary will get rid of fleas on a dog. And I was wondering if that's true and if it's in any chemicals they use on dogs.
Nope. No. Sorry. None of the herbal remedies work. In fact, some of the herbal remedies that are out there to control ticks and fleas, and primarily fleas, are absolutely useless, and it may actually be dangerous. Some of the things that contain, like, there is a lemon extract, D-L-limonene, can be, you know, quite hazardous if you overdose it or, you know, the pet licks it. And what we found is that none of the herbs and things like rosemary are effective. And I think, you know, you're just going to have to bite the dust and say, if I either have to keep my dog, you know, confined to an area where I can control wildlife and not let anything come and go so that they're not going to be exposed to fleas and ticks, or I can consider using a product that is recommended by my veterinarian. The, you know, ultrasonic collars don't work. Herbal remedies don't work. I had somebody that said, this is what I want to use, and it was some kind of cedar oil that somebody was making up in their kitchen, and I said, show me the evidence where it's gone through testing and what would happen if the dog were to ingest this. And of course, there's nothing there in the literature. And so I would guess that what you were reading was probably not a veterinary journal, but something else.
All right. There we go. Thanks, Dalton, for calling. And an email from Kim. My 7-year-old mixed breed dog has red inflamed upper gums, feel hard, not mushy, just the outer gums. I normally brush and keep tartar preventing toys available. It isn't gingivitis from decay. She chews sticks, is active and a good eater. The PATH report was lots of neutrophils and acute inflammatory stuff. What could cause this?
Wow. Well, you know, I'm glad that she went in and had some biopsies done because, you know, gingivitis is very common in dogs, and we'll usually see it along the gum line, and they'll, you know, they get it from just the fact that they don't brush their teeth. It sounds like this owner, you know, is brushing teeth. I don't think sticks are a great thing for dogs to chew on. I just had a dog in the other day that had a stick wedged across the roof of its mouth, and the owner didn't even know it until there was a bad odor, and it was because it had so much necrotic tissue in the roof of its mouth where the stick was in contact with the teeth. So probably avoid sticks if possible. Our dentist says any toys that if you hit yourself with them and it hurts, you probably don't want to put it in the dog's mouth. There are some, I seem to be stuck on this immune problem, but there are some immune-mediated gum diseases that dogs can get, and it would be something that may require kind of a different pathologist to look at it, or even submit it in a different type of fixative, so that they can get some answers for you that way. You may want to consider having a second opinion on the pathology report by a veterinary dentist, because they're going to be looking at this more often and may be able to read between the lines as to what cells the pathologist was seeing and actually what may be going on. And so I think it's time for a second opinion. This sounds pretty painful, and it may just mean that piece of paper getting sent in so that it can be looked at by, or maybe even the slides looked at by another pathologist.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Always great to have her along, and always great to have you listening in. Thanks for doing that. And call us with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234. If you got a photo of your kitty or your dog or your pet, give us that photo. Go to my Facebook page. You can post it at The Larry Mueller Show. We have Linus, an email from Linus. I have numerous outdoor cats I take care of. Just the other day, I found one of my cats had died during birth. I found 3 kittens that didn't make it, and the mother dead as well. This is not the first time I have found this. Very sad. And Is this common?
Well, what I get concerned about is, you know, if these are outdoor cats, and perhaps this is like a young female cat that may, you know, I don't know how old the mother was, but sometimes it's just their body size is so small and they can get pregnant very early, kind of like a, you know, a teenager getting pregnant. They may have had a dystocia or inability to pass the kitten, and without receiving veterinary care to be able to help them, perhaps a C-section, they're going to die. I mean, and so, and that's, it can be very traumatic for them. And then, of course, if the kittens are not able to nurse, then they're going to die as well, unless they're taken in and raised as foster kittens and hand-raised. So if this happens, one of the things that you can do is have an autopsy done, or a necropsy, as we call it in the veterinary world, and they would be able to give you some help with saying, you know, this is what caused her to die. They would look at evidence for infectious diseases that may be stressing the cat and not allowing her to be able to have the strength to be able to reproduce. Cats that are, you know, being bred by stray cats have a higher rate of things like feline leukemia virus and FIV, which can suppress their immune system and open them up to all kinds of diseases. So, you know, any of those things are possible. I think the best thing you could do for these kitties is get them spayed and neutered. Yes, you can keep them as, you know, let them stay outside if you want, but, you know, trapping them and getting them in, and there are now some, like, low-cost spay and neuter clinics. We have one in the Madison area called Spay Me, which is over in the Sun Prairie area. We have a group called Friends of Ferals that will often help out with this as well. And so there's lots of ways to be able to get this done, to be able to keep the cats as healthy as you can outside without adding to the population problem.
Bob in Wauwatosa, hello to you.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about our English Field Cocker Spaniel. He's 12 and a half years old and in excellent health generally. However, last October, he was diagnosed as having hepatitis. And specifically, he has excessive copper in his liver. He's on three different meds. He's on Denimarin, Colchicine, and Ursodiol, mm-hmm. whatever those are.
Okay.
And he's also on Royal Cane and Kibble. He seems to be getting along fine. His liver panel numbers have come down significantly. Here's my question. Should we have our household cold water tested for copper? Our house is about 60 years old, and I'm wondering, have I been putting, you know, water from our tap with possibly excessive copper in it in his water dish? I don't know.
Yeah, one of the things that we'll do in dogs that have had liver damage, especially if they've got some type of a copper storage disease problem, and the issue is which came first. Did your dog have some kind of underlying problem that caused them to store more copper in their liver, or is it the fact that the liver's sick where they can't deal with the normal levels of copper? And so there are diets that you can use that are liver-friendly diets that tend to be a lower copper diet. We usually don't worry too much about the water source, though. The drugs that your dog is on are to help prevent a scarring of the liver, and to, as a, you know, it's like another one, the Denimarin is a drug that is kind of a supplement that helps support liver function a little bit better too. So I wouldn't worry too much about the water, but, you know, if you are concerned, I'd say maybe just get bottled water for your dogs, you know, using distilled water, you know, you can use that. But the fact that your dog's still on a commercial diet, I'd be looking at maybe switching to a therapeutic diet that is specific for liver disease.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, I thought that's what the what the Royal Canin was.
Oh, well, maybe I'm wrong. It could be that if it is one that you're getting from your veterinarian.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, it is. Good. Okay, because the Royal Canin does make over-the-counter foods for dogs as well. And so you can go to pet stores and buy lots of different brands of, you know, Royal Canin food. But, yeah, if it's going to be a specialized diet for liver health, then, you know, obviously that's a therapeutic diet that you're getting from your veterinarian. Wonderful.
Yeah, we can only order it through the vets.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm glad your dog's doing better and that they went to, you know, finding out what was causing it. And, yeah, we have many patients that have the same type of thing with copper problems. So
he was one of your patients.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Cool.
For that, I thank you.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, I just went to my Facebook page while you were talking, and I clicked like on a picture of Lily, the guinea pig.
Oh, my goodness. Look at
Teresa.
That.
Teresa.
Oh, my goodness. That is so cute. Yep.
Oh, and look at here. And David sent a picture of, what dog is that?
I don't know. Terrier mix. So very cute, though. White
with
some black.
Oh, man, it's a beautiful dog.
Yeah.
David has a 5-year-old terrier mix, and this is a very, very pretty dog. Sound sensitive. Anything that sounds like thunder scares him. And normally very independent, except for booming sounds.
Yeah, and that's that time of the year, and I get a lot of questions on this. And so there's a number of things that you can try. One is if the dog is inside, give them a bomb shelter. If it's a closet, put a dog bed in it, or, you know, let them go down in the basement. Sometimes they're happier if they're down there using white noise, running a dehumidifier, something that's going to mask the noises as well. They do make this device called the Thunder Shirt or the Anxiety Wrap that may be worth trying. Before you go out and buy one, these were actually based on some work that was done by a woman named Linda Tellington Jones. And if you go to Dr. Google and enter T-Touch Body Wrap or T-Touch Wrap, it'll show you how to do one with an ACE bandage. And that may, you know, if you find that that helps your dog, it kind of gives them, like swaddling a baby, makes them feel a little more secure. Some dogs are happier that way as well. So you may, if that works, then you might want to go to a safer version, such as one of the commercially available jackets, to see if that helps your dog. Then we start looking at, you know, some of the over-the-counter preparations, the herbal products and different things, which dogs tend to override very easily. But I think they usually are pretty safe, and it's worth trying. We've had some success with using melatonin, which is, again, one of these supplements that's available over-the-counter. Why it works, I have no idea, but some dogs with noise phobias seem to respond very well to that. Then we look at prescription drugs, and that would be some of our anti-anxiety drugs to allow the dog to be able to cope in these fearful situations and maybe even develop some coping skills that will allow them to realize that, boy, you know, these noises aren't that scary after all, and you can gradually get them tapered off the medication. But it's a tough one, and once it gets going, it's really hard to get this fixed.
Mary in Sturgeon Bay, what's on your mind?
I have a little kitty who we got from a shelter, and he had licked off a lot of his fur. Off his legs and his tummy and as much of his back as he could reach. So I took him home, took him to the dermatologist in Appleton. They did all the testing except for specific allergy testing.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't find anything. So I brought him home. We've tried non-grain diets. We've tried Depo-Medrol. We've had, because sometimes he licks so much, he eventually gets an infection. He's been on Clavamox a couple times. Now he's on another one. But the licking just doesn't seem to stop. And it's like he licks. He just sits there and licks and licks and licks. Is it possible he has OCD? Or is it possible?
We used to think that the majority of cats that did this, that we actually called it psychoactive alopecia, meaning it was his brain affecting him to lick. Mm-hmm. But over the years, we've discovered that there's a lot more things out there that cause a cat to lick and groom. We actually refer to this as fur mowing. And there's a whole host of things. And so typically, I'll do skin scrapings to look for parasites. I'll do a fungal culture to look for ringworm, which is a fungal infection that cats can get, and get, you know, those look into those. I usually don't treat these cats with steroids unless, you know, especially the long-lasting steroids. They can be very irritating and are one of the things that's been linked to causing fibrosarcomas at the injection site. So I tend to try to avoid those if I possibly can. I'll go through a trial for treating a mite called Demodex mites in cats, which is using a lime sulfur dip.
Is it possible that,
yeah,
we tried that when we first got him.
Okay, and then a food trial. And that means using a hypoallergenic diet, And this is not going to be a grain-free diet. You need to go with a very, usually a hydrolyzed protein diet for an extended period of time, usually 8 to 12 weeks, to see if the cat does better. Then, if they don't respond to that, then we look into allergy testing before we start assuming that this is just a psychological problem. Okay. Your cat sounds miserable. I think it really needs a, needs a diet if you've gone through everything else.
Right now, he's curled up fast asleep.
Yeah.
And the other one is sitting here grooming. She has cerebellar hypoplasia.
Okay, okay.
So I have a couple of cats.
Okay. But talk to your vet about the diet, and it may be that both cats are going to have to go on it since they can't get a mouthful of any other type of food when they're on this this hypoallergenic diet.
Well, he can. I can keep them separated because she can't climb, and so I feed him on the counter.
Okay.
So
okay.
That's great. So,
okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yep, thanks very much for calling. Jackie in La Crosse wonders, what determines what nutritional information is required on pet food packaging? How would one pursue getting phosphorus content required on cat food?
I'm not sure why she wants phosphorus on the cat food. It's one of those things that if you're dealing with a reputable food company that does feeding trials, not one that just follows a recipe, but actually does feeding trials, they're going to have balanced calcium and phosphorus in it. It's one of those things where it's probably not necessary to put that on. You can find out the percentage by contacting the company. That is information that does not have to be put on the label, but any pet food manufacturer should be able to provide you with that information.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, a professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. She'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we talk about your pet's health. You know, it can be really stressful when your pet is ill. A lot of information out there. Some of it good and some of it not so good. As a matter of fact, you'll have contradicting information. So it's hard to know what to believe. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is the person you should believe with the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She's with us today to answer your pet's health questions. Dr. Sandy, great to have you back.
Well, that's very nice of you to say you can believe me. But, you know, even I am often very opinionated, and I think getting multiple opinions is helpful, but it's just the source of where you get those opinions from that you have to really question. And you know, there's so much stuff out there that is just not backed up by research, and you have to learn how to look into it and say, show me the evidence. So, yeah.
Well, Carol in Oak Creek may want some evidence. I don't know. She wants probably a question answered.
Okay.
Let's see. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thank you. I have two elderly cats, and just a few days ago, I had to put my 17-year-old cat down.
Oh.
She was obviously getting old. I had her into the vet for checkups and was told that she was doing great for a cat her age. But the other day, she had a tragic accident and fell off the counter, broke her front leg in two places.
Oh.
And the vet said she was facing surgery or a splint, you know, from her shoulders to her paw, or euthanasia. And weighing all the options, I couldn't see through putting her through pain, so I put her to sleep. My two questions are, did I make the right decision?
Oh.
What could I have done or should I have done to prevent her from jumping up on high places? I have another elderly cat. I don't want this to happen again.
Yeah. This is a tough situation to be in, and you were in that position of having your cat there hurting and having to make a snap decision to be able to do what you thought was best for your cat. And I don't think anybody would fault you for saying, you know, if it was the cost, if it was what she would have to go through. You know your cat better than anybody else. And, you know, it never is easy, no matter whether it's something that you've known about for a long time, like your pet has cancer and you've been dealing with it for months and, you know, when's the time going to be there? It's every time. But when you're dealing with a traumatic situation like that,
you made the right decision.
You did. You know, there's going to be guilt. There's why did I let her up on the counter?
I couldn't prevent it. I was in the room.
Right.
I couldn't explained to her. She's
Like, oh, we shouldn't be jumping up. Yeah, and you know, cats love to be up high. And what I've done for both of my older cats who are over 10 is I got a new cat tree that actually has multiple levels so that they, and ramps, and it takes up half my living room, but they can climb up and get to these higher spots, and yet they, it doesn't require much jumping or anything. And so that was one of the things that I did to keep a cat off the kitchen counter. I mean, counters are a wonderful place. They can sometimes find food. There's good odors. They're up and elevated, which is like cats like to be. And so there's a device on the market called SCAT, and it's S-S-S-C-A-T. It's a can of compressed air with a motion sensor. You can go to YouTube and watch lots of videos of owners that have set this up on their counter. And, you know, it keeps the cat off because they don't like that hissing sound. The punishment doesn't come from you. It comes from this can spraying air at them. So, you know, I think that might be something to consider trying. But again, it may startle your older cat enough that the same thing could happen. They could, you know, jump off the counter in a hurry and hurt themselves. I just wonder, I mean, most cats are going to be able to survive that kind of trauma without any trouble. I mean, you hear about cats falling from top, you know, buildings and so on and having, you know, very little injury done. I'm wondering if your cat didn't have some type of pathologic bone disease, whether it had a bone tumor or very fragile bones for some reason, which caused the fracture. It just,
that could be, because she was obviously getting straggly, not grooming herself. But the, I mean, all her tests came back well.
And I
just didn't know.
You did the right thing. You know, for you, for her. You know, having a cat that is set in their ways, wearing a cast, you know, putting her through major surgery at that point in her life, it may have been able to be something that she could have survived, but you never know, you know?
Yeah, she snapped them in half. I mean, and then and there was a piece floating in there, too.
Poor thing.
I couldn't see, you know, putting her through more pain.
I'm so sorry for your loss, but it's something that
you
all pet
right
owners
thing.
Have to deal with at some point or another. So,
thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And again, you did the right thing, Carol. Don't worry about that, at least. John and Banger, I thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I was calling in regards, I had heard, I want to say either last month or the month before, a website or association for dog foods. I have a 9-month-old and 10 or 11-year-old German Shepherd, the older one. It's kind of a cast off from various ways. My wife is kind of against the corn in dog food because she figures if my dog can't digest it, why pay for it?
But they can digest it. That's just it. They can digest it. Dogs are not carnivores. They're an omnivore like us, and we eat corn. And dogs can eat corn as long as it's processed. And I think the best advice I give owners when it comes to looking at pet foods is, one, you know, turn off the commercials. I'm so tired of some of these pet food commercials that are on the air. And they're often by companies that don't do any feeding trials, that have just are following a recipe. So we don't know how digestible the food is. And they, you know, they claim to have all these benefits, but it's like, show me the evidence. And most of them, they can't do that. It's all, you know, just, you know, your pet is their evidence. And I think another word of advice is, don't look at the ingredients label, okay? So many people get sucked into looking at what went into it. If we looked at what went into making a delicious chocolate cake, we would look at all the baking soda and the other things that were in there, and you'd be like, wow, why do I have all this stuff in here? You know, we just want the cake. And I think that's the way we have to look at dog food is each one of those ingredients serves a purpose, and they're there to be able to make the food complete and balanced. And so corn, as you know, I think the big reason why people say, I don't want corn in my food, dog's food, is because they have misinformation like you do that they can't digest it. They can. That they feel that it doesn't provide good nutrition. It provides fatty acids. It provides energy. It provides vitamins. There's protein. I mean, it is part of the regular diet. And the other thing I hear from people is that, hey, corn causes allergies. It's one of the least allergenic things you can give to the dog. Most of the food allergies we see are based on the animal protein that's in there, not the grain. grains that are in the food. The grain-free diets are a fad that got started a few years ago when we had the melamine scare with the wheat gluten meal. And people went from wheat gluten meal is bad to wheat is bad to all grains are bad. And it's just a farce. And so look at the package. See this. You want to see a statement that said that the food has gone through AFCO feeding trials, not just formulated to meet AFCO standards, which stands for American Association of Feed Control Officials. And yeah, and look for the evidence. Who is, you know, so the veterinary, I'm trying to think what their website is, but if you look up American Association of Veterinary Nutritionists, there's going to be lots of great information on their website regarding picking dog foods and so on.
American Association of
Veterinary Nutritionists.
Yep. Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. By the way, the skunk recipe, a lot of people have called in saying, what's that recipe for that taking away the skunk smell from my dog? And we've posted that up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You don't have to be a member of Facebook to go to it. And it's all of the directions are right there. And it's, frankly, pretty cheap when you, it's just household products.
Yeah, it's just stuff. You have to have fresh peroxide, though, and that's the key. You can't have a bottle that's half used because it's not going to work as well.
And it can't be stored. It has to be used.
Yes, you have to use it. You mix it and use it. If you put it in a bottle, it'll explode.
Yeah,
so,
there you go.
Because it releases oxygen. Yep.
Well, Katie sent us a picture of her three cats, Himmel, Duke, and Kite.
Yeah.
Over there. And then we've got Jennifer sent George on his backside and Lily curled up on the pillow.
You know, cats are doing what they do best. I mean, cats sleep on average about 18 hours a day.
Oh,
and so, you know, what we're seeing is all these cats sleeping. And, you know, that's why we have to keep them active with cat trees and cat toys and things.
Look at this little Shih Tzu from Cheryl.
Yeah, very cute. And that dog looks like it's in good physical body shape. And I'm happy to see that we, you know, it looks like it's got a waist and just doing a good job of keeping them groomed, too.
And here's Terry's
14-year-old Belgian Malinois. Whoa.
It's a beautiful dog.
Beautiful dog. And, you know, to have a dog that size and breed live to be 14 and look that happy. Boy, it needs a little doggy Grecian formula, I think, there with the white hair. But beautiful dog.
Oh, those are wonderful. So we had a whole string of wonderful photos on my Facebook page as well as that skunk recipe. So go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you can take a look at the photos and get that recipe. Sandra in Greendale, thank you very much for calling. Hi.
Hi. Okay. I have a 15-year-old Maine Coon. She's beautiful, long-haired calico. She sleeps with me every night, and about 2 weeks ago, I went to bed and I laid down and she urinated all over my pillow.
Oh.
So I took her into the vet and they did a urinary fecal blood work. Nothing was wrong.
Okay.
Took her home. About 3 days later, she did the same thing, only at the foot of my bed.
Okay.
I mean, still on the bed, but at the foot of my bed.
And this is happening, is she just laying there and urine's leaking out, or are you seeing her squat, or are you just finding the urine on your bed?
No, I'm finding it.
Okay, all right. And you only have, she's your only cat?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you did the right thing. You always want to rule out medical problems. And so a 15-year-old cat, some of the big things that I would be looking at is, do we have a cat that has kidney disease where they're not producing, they're producing more dilute urine, and they just, you know, have to go more frequently, and maybe she's got a little arthritis and can't make it to the litter box, and boy, the comforter and the pillow are nice and absorbent, I'm just going to use these. I'd probably be looking at maybe doing a urine culture on her as well, even though urinary tract infections are fairly uncommon in young cats, they're much more common as cats get older, and so I don't know what they looked at with the urine. But culture may be indicated as well. Sometimes cats can, you know, start having accidents if they have a urinary tract infection. This would not be something I would do if it was a young cat. Most young cats are just so resistant to getting urinary tract infections because their urine is so concentrated. But a couple things that you may want to try. If she's checked out fine physically, then we start looking at this as potentially a behavior problem. I had an elderly cat that was doing the same thing, not on my bed, but in a corner of my bedroom. And what I ended up doing is moving a litter box into my bedroom. And I know that sounds like, oh, gross, but it made it easier for the cat. He spent most of his time sleeping on my bed, and to have to go, you know, off the bed, down the stairs, around the corner to a landing where the litter box was just more than his old joints wanted to deal with. So by providing multiple litter boxes easy access, sometimes we end up having to cut the litter box down so the cat doesn't have to jump in to make it easier to get in. Some of the things like this plastic cement mixing trays tend to be fairly low profile. Those work well. The sweater boxes and things that you can fairly easily cut down will give your cat lots of room to move. But that would be what I would do initially if everything came back fine on the medical evaluation, is provide her with a litter box in your bedroom, and hopefully that will do the trick.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much, Sandra, for calling. Tom in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I just took my lab Abby in for removal of a tumor on her chest. The doctor said it might be an adenocarcinoma. It was growing fairly fast.
Okay. Are you having it biopsied, having it sent in to be evaluated?
Yeah, we're going to have histology done on
Okay.
I was just wondering, what is the treatment for that?
Well, it depends. When a tumor is sent in, regardless of the type of the tumor, they want to look to see if there's clean margins, which means that you don't have cancer cells at the cut edge, which would mean that there's more cancer cells left in the body. So that's one of the things that they'll look at, is, you know, going around to all the edges of the mass and making sure that it's clean that way. The other thing that they will do is, depending on the type of the tumor that it turns out to be, they may grade it. And so various tumors will have, you know, numbers or high grade, low grade, or whatever. And sometimes surgery with a low grade tumor with clean margins is curative, and we've got it under control, and we just keep an eye on them to make sure that nothing else is coming back. Some tumors, because they may have a higher rate of spreading through the blood and metastasizing, we may be recommending doing periodic chest x-rays, abdominal ultrasounds, to be able to see if there's any spread elsewhere in the body that can be addressed earlier rather than later. Preferably, we like to have that done prior to going into having the surgery done. So if I have a dog in with a lump that looks suspicious, I'll do a needle aspirate, try to get some, you know, a preliminary diagnosis that way with just some cells. That will then be able to tell me what to tell the surgeon, how wide a margin to take. But you know, it sounds like your vet's right on top of it with getting it removed, having it looked at, and, you know, then we base therapy on that. And hopefully for your dog, surgery is going to be curative. If not, radiation therapy, chemotherapy, really is going to depend on the type of tumor it is.
Good luck. Thank you for calling. Karen in Janesville, hello to you.
Hi. I have a 10-year-old English Springer Spaniel who developed seborrheic dermatitis over the winter. I've tried some of the things. The vet wanted me to bathe her twice a week. I started with Benzoyl Plus. It was hard. I did it a couple of times a week for a while. I have a very busy schedule, and it's miserable. It was so cold, and she was shivering with that long hair. It mm-hmm. takes about a week for her to dry.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it didn't seem to make much difference. So he switched to Sebalux.
Okay.
I've tried that. He also said to put her on omega 3, and one of the things we were giving her, tablets that we were using ourselves that are 1,000 mm-hmm. 900 milligrams, but they're enteric coated, and we thought, well, maybe that isn't that good for a dog to have the enteric coated,
yeah.
But it has other things in it that we didn't know if dogs would need. So I'm wondering at this point, so even I'll bathe her, and when she dries, even though I scrub her really well, a few hours later when she's good and dry, I see that there's still That oily flake.
Yeah. First of all, whenever we have a dog that this age starts to develop skin problems, you really need to start looking at, is there some other underlying problem, rather than just saying your dog has seborrhea, which is flaky skin. And so things that I would be looking into would be, you know, is she hypothyroid? Did they do thyroid levels on her?
She's been on thyroid for a while, and that was what I was wondering too, but supposedly the test they did came back okay. Maybe we should have a more detailed panel done.
Not necessarily. Once they've been diagnosed with being hypothyroid, it's just a matter of doing the simple test to make sure that her thyroid level is within normal range. So I'm glad that's been looked at. There are some other endocrine problems that can affect the skin too. And then there are some other like parasitic problems. They're usually itchy with it, but there's a mite that's called Kylotiella that is often given the nickname walking dandruff. And, you know, so doing some skin scrapings. I have had some dogs with a bacterial skin infection that show up as flaking as well. And so, you know, sometimes we'll have to do cultures and so on to try to get some answers. But in the short term, what I'd be recommending is, now that we're heading into warmer weather, although your dog may look a little funny, it might be much easier for you to keep your dog treated effectively by having them clipped down. And so, you know, getting a good, you know, shave job done so that it's easier for you to do some of the grooming and things that may need to be done. You may want to consider, you know, if it's not being managed with just, you know, routine bathing with anti-seborrheic shampoos, consider getting a biopsy done to see, is there some other weird underlying problem that could be causing this? And skin biopsies are really easy and not invasive. A little local, a little punch, and you're done. So,
there you go.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Karen. Back to the Facebook page for a minute, because we've got Gerald sent our trio, Chippy the chipmunk, Emma, and Ashley the cats, all eating out of the same dish.
Well, Chippy has been on here before, and but I think we just saw pictures of Chippy, and now we've got the rest of the family there.
It's really cool. And then Trista sent a picture of her new puppy, Beatrice, with a big brother named Henry.
Okay.
Cutie pie.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
So lots of really cool pictures on the Facebook page. Facebook question from Andrew. They have a 15-year-old Norwegian forest cat inside his whole life. We're moving to a house with a screened-in porch and grass in it. Is there anything we should do for him to be safe inside there? He won't come in contact with other animals, but we'll be able to play in the grass.
What a great environment for this cat, you know. This was in Florida, I'd say heartworm preventative, just because it's much more prevalent in this area, not as prevalent in cats, so I wouldn't worry about it. Very unlikely that fleas and ticks could be a problem. You never know if wildlife gets in there, if there's breaks or whatever. They may want to consider a flea control thing. But being a 15-year-old cat, the chance of them picking up some of these infectious diseases like feline leukemia and the fact that it's enclosed, very, very remote. So I think let your cat be happy and maybe talk to your vet about some flea control.
And one, have we talked about the heartworm preventative?
No, we didn't.
We've got about 30 seconds to do that.
Yeah, Veerback, who makes a product called Ivorheart Plus, recalled all of their line because they were having problems with efficacy. You know, so it is kind of a generic version of HeartGuard, and many people have decided to go with using that. So look at the box you've got, and they contact the company. They will reimburse you for it and talk to your vet about what would be an alternative drug to go on.
So, yeah, and don't wait on that
one. Don't wait. You need to be on it now.
Sandy, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. We'll see you in about a month.
That sounds great. Second Tuesday.
Second Tuesday, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be back the second Tuesday in June. Tomorrow at 11, we'll find out what makes soil healthy and how we can improve and maintain it. And then at 11:45, we'll get some tips on composting, including how to put worms to work. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening here. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.